disclaimer. The following broadcast gives a true and honest account of the events described, and all evidence and details herein are solely factual. What you are about to hear is real and may disturb you. Caution is strongly advised. Welcome to Dead Souls Social Club.
If you enjoy our show and find our research interesting, please consider supporting us. Head on over to ko-fi.com/deadsouls and donate a few bucks to our research and investigations. That's www.ko-fi.com/deadsouls. We truly appreciate you helping us out, but if Instagram is more your thing, you can find us over there. Just type in Dead Souls Podcast and we'll come up. As always, thank you for joining us. Michael Jackson. Let that name sink in and trigger all your relevant memories. I very much doubt there is anyone listening here who doesn't know who that is. Michael Jackson. One of the biggest, most enigmatic, mysterious, and significant cultural figures of the 20th century. Whether you were a fan of his or not, there is no denying the magnitude of his legacy and how he left a lasting imprint on the world. Jackson was complex, fraught with issues both personal and professional, but throughout his lifetime managed to hold on to the throne that the media, his fans and peers would all call the King of Pop. He was possibly the most famous and popular entertainer of all time. But this isn't a biography. Far from it. Maybe I should clear something up before we start. It will make things more transparent down the line. I am not, nor have I ever been, a fan of Michael Jackson. I think I own a CD of Thriller someplace, which was gifted to me a number of years back, but that's about it. I have no emotional ties to MJ or his life story, and I'm fairly indifferent to him as an artist. It doesn't matter to me if he released amazing entertainment or the world's worst entertainment. My opinion of him remains the same. My cousin, however, who I've been close with since we were very young, was a big fan of Michael Jackson. So that meant that throughout the 80s and 90s and 2000s, I usually had what Michael Jackson was up to on my radar via second-hand updates from her. So I was aware, you could say, of the latest Michael Jackson media headlines. My cousin's interest in Jackson started to wane in the early 2000s when MJ faced criminal charges over alleged child molestation, the third time he'd been accused of such actions. My cousin was a mother to a young child, and she didn't think she could stand by the artist given all the damning things that she had heard about him in the press. His death came and went, and it had been a number of years since I last thought about Michael Jackson. Then around Christmas time last year, I was gifted a book by a friend of mine. The book was a textbook that discussed the theorized psychological evaluations of various well-known figures and celebrities. Psychology being my jam, I read it from cover to cover in one sitting and I absolutely loved it. Thought-provoking and really well-researched. It got me thinking about the same research that could be applied to other people. To cut the long story short, over Christmas dinner, my family were discussing what gifts they were thankful to have received this year. And I spoke about the book, and one of the comments I received back was from my cousin, who agreed that the book did sound very interesting, and she asked who was featured within its pages. Michael Jackson wasn't featured, but after I reeled a list of names off, he was the first name that my cousin replied with as someone who she thought would be a fascinating psychological evaluation to read. And here I am, nearly 5 months later, not with a psychological evaluation of Michael Jackson, but instead a rabbit hole of research that fate has led me down. Now, at the start of every episode, we always run our disclaimer that states that all information and evidence broadcast throughout the following episode is genuine, real, and 100% truthful. And this episode is no exception. There is, however, I feel, a need to reiterate these facts, as I feel this is a subject where emotions often run high, and generally individuals can be very passionate about one side of the argument or the other. For clarity, I am just presenting facts, data, details, and evidence that has all been entirely independently corroborated and proven to be genuine. Anything that has the slight chance of being ambiguous or even slightly leaning toward being untrue has been left out. I want to leave no room for argument. This is Michael Jackson, The Truth. Do you remember back in the 90s and 2000s when Michael Jackson was still alive? Back in high school when there would be so many paedophile and pervert jokes about him? It was generally assumed by many that after so many allegations and investigations that Jackson was guilty of child abuse, right? He paid off those people that accused him so much money, he had to be guilty. Then there were the other children and families that came forward. That guy was guilty for sure. Do you remember when he was interviewed by Martin Bashir and he admitted in that documentary that he lets children sleep in his bed? What the hell? What a pervert. Who does that? Do you remember when the press called him Wacko Jacko on a daily basis and revealed story after story about how strange and bizarre he was? The guy had a pet chimpanzee. The guy slept in a hyperbaric chamber to remain young. The guy tried on several occasions to buy the bones of John Mayrick, the elephant man. The guy was obsessed with llamas and took two pet llamas to the recording studio with him. The guy was absolutely crazy, right? He lived a reclusive lifestyle. No one knew what the hell went on at the Neverland Ranch, and he lived alone. Well, tonight I'm going to find out what's true. Who was the real Michael Jackson? Was he this creepy, reclusive pervert? Or has the media painted a harsh picture of lies? Let's dig in. First up, let me cite my sources for this episode. This one took a lot of research and data gathering, and I wouldn't have been able to do it without the expertise of the following people. First up is Charles Thompson. Thompson is a British investigative journalist who has worked for The Guardian, Huffington Post, and Mojo magazine. He has won multiple journalistic awards for his work, including a very coveted Ray Fitzwalter Award for his investigative work in the Shoebury paedophile ring, which he exposed and helped bring down. Next up is filmmaker Danny Wu. He's a Chinese-Canadian investigative filmmaker. Third up is Dr. Bob Johnson. Dr. Johnson is the senior clinical psychiatrist at HMP Parkhurst and Ashworth High Security Psychiatric Hospital. Finally, Grace Morgan. She's a senior GS researcher at the UK government with over 15 years of experience into social and behavioural research into group, society and individual behaviours in support of policy, debate and government decision making. All four of these individuals played a pivotal role in this episode, and I thank them very much for their research and data. Now that the introductions are out of the way, let's go. Michael Joseph Jackson was born on the 29th of August 1958. The seventh of nine children born to Joe and Catherine Jackson in a two-bedroom home in Gary, Indiana. Catherine worked part-time at Sears department store, and Joe was a crane operator at United States Steel. They were very much a working-class family. Michael started performing at the age of six when his father formed a band from the Jackson Brothers. This band would eventually become the Jackson Five, with Michael on lead vocals due to his natural talent. Their father Joe would manage the band and was famously very abusive to the boys, standing with a belt in rehearsals ready to whip and beat the boys if they messed up and didn't perform well. This would leave a lasting and deep psychological mark on Michael, who was very young at the time, and he grew up with a great fear and dislike of his father Joe. Michael described Joe in a 2003 interview as a terrifying tyrant who regularly inflicted violence on him and his siblings in pursuit of perfection. Michael also had what he and the family would call a very lonely and isolated childhood, with him having little friends and spending most of his time on his own when he wasn't performing or rehearsing. Having this type of childhood and growing up in the spotlight had profound consequences to Michael's psychological development. This is very much in the public eye and has been debated and conversed for many years, but Michael was isolated throughout his career. So famous was he that it was difficult for him to go outside without being mobbed, and finding it difficult to make friends as a result. He would end up living a reclusive existence, even though he would regularly perform to millions of fans the world over who adored him. Numerous psychologists have surmised that Jackson's psychological development was impacted when his real childhood was taken from him at such a young age and replaced with a forced focus on performing and rehearsing. This developmental impact is demonstrated by Jackson's seemingly childlike demeanor, behaviors, and interests well into adulthood. Jackson had a deep interest in Peter Pan, which Jackson himself stated in a 2001 interview was because he related to the character and wished he could forever remain a child. In addition to this, Jackson, between 1974 and his death in 2009, donated more than $500 million to children's charities and regularly wore a black armband in support of children's rights. Some people saw this as a beautiful and innocent thing. Others saw it as a creepy, self-indulgent, fake show. On February 19th, 1996, Jarvis Cocker, the lead singer of British Britpop band Pulp, crashed the stage during Jackson's performance of his single Earth Song at the Brit Awards over what he considered a sickening portrayal of messianic imagery and Jackson's self-image of a Christ-like figure who could heal children and save the world. Side note, in a very British state of affairs, Jarvis Cocker was subsequently arrested for the stunt and represented legally by comedian Bob Mortimer, who had practiced law prior to his celebrity. The 1980s and 1990s, when Jackson was at his peak level of fame, was a time before social media and widespread internet use. A time where you could only get information about your favourite celebrity from the media, magazines and newspapers, which we now consider less than honest with their reporting. Figures like Michael Jackson, Princess Diana, Amy Winehouse and Whitney Houston, to name a few, were hounded by the tabloid press. Rarely a day went by where their names were not mentioned in the press, and this was due to their huge celebrity. Any story that involved their names would sell papers, would sell advertising, would draw huge ratings. Anything they did, true or not, generated millions of pounds or dollars. The free press and loose media standards meant it was, and still is to some capacity, open season on celebrities. The media could print or run a story about anything they wanted, true or false, simply citing an anonymous source. With media as your only source of information, many people accepted the information given to them as fact in the absence of anything else. The response to this by many celebrities was fierce protectionism of their private lives, and there was none more famous and protective of their private life than Michael Jackson.
Police want to know what Michael Jackson's really up to, and Mary Jo goes it alone. The Michael Jackson case blows wide open. The DA demands to know where he is.
The investigation is continuing.
Police want to know whether he's changing his appearance. They're ready to fly to Europe. Liz Taylor flies to his defense.
I am a friend of Michael Jackson's, and I love him like a son.
And criminal charges are threatened. Tonight, the latest from London, Los Angeles, and Washington. Michael, the heat is on.
On August the 17th, 1993, the Los Angeles Police Department opened an investigation against Michael Jackson. The investigation was based on an allegation Michael had sexually molested a 13-year-old boy by the name of Jordan Chandler. Jordan was a young friend of Jackson's, and the two had spent a lot of time together over the previous 18 months. On January 25, 1994, Michael Jackson settled a civil lawsuit against him with the Chandler family. The New York Times was quoted as saying on January 26, 1994, that this settlement would leave Jackson open to any number of similar lawsuits and should have been considered further. Charles Thompson, the investigative journalist who revealed and brought down the Shoebury sex abuse ring in 2017, stated, "Clinically, there's a difference between the standard paedophile model and Jackson's behaviours. The first difference is that the cases I have investigated were all criminal cases, and there was no real financial incentive to make an allegation. And then, in the cases where we've seen convictions, you have victims who were credible, who were consistent, and that's never been the case in the allegations against Michael Jackson. They've never been consistent. They've always turned out to be perjurious and people who were just looking for a payout." The United States government, for all it says about nations like Russia and China, certainly don't like its citizens gaining too much power or influence either. Take J. Edgar Hoover's surveillance and intimidation files, for example. Michael Jackson was no different in regards to this treatment. He was one of the most famous people on the planet. He was also the target of intrusive FBI scrutiny and surveillance. But what do those FBI files tell us? Well, they are now in the public domain, albeit slightly redacted. But what they do is give us an insight into those 1993 accusations and the subsequent investigation. Firstly, no child porn was ever found at Neverland Ranch. In fact, it was widely reported in the press at the time that there was child pornography found prior to the time of the trial. And due to all the inaccurate reporting, the judge and the prosecutor both released the stipulation publicly, which was that no child pornography had ever been found at Neverland or any other Michael Jackson's properties. That's the judge in the trial confirming that due to the amount of untrue facts in the press, and even the prosecutor saying that there was no child porn found, which is a huge statement to make given the prosecutor wants a conviction. Regarding what the FBI files tell us, they show us that for over a decade the FBI was intermittently involved in investigating Michael Jackson. There's no evidence of sustained surveillance or sustained investigation, but the authorities occasionally calling on the FBI to assist them with an investigation into various matters. Nonetheless, more than 20 different FBI departments investigated Michael Jackson at one time or another. Despite significant attempts, none of them could find any evidence of any wrongdoing at any point in the 20 investigations. Included in the files were details regarding all of the computers that were seized from the Neverland Ranch in regards to the 2005 Arvizo trial. FBI analysts were unable to find anything incriminating on any single one of the machines. Whilst the FBI files alone don't exonerate Michael Jackson, they certainly don't incriminate him. This is important given the media stories and speculation from 1993 that stated a significant amount of child and animal porn was found at Neverland, with a huge amount of the pornography being homosexual in nature. If that's not a deliberate smear and attack on Michael by the press, I don't know what is. It's quite shocking, really. Michael Borok, a forensic psychiatrist at the University of Cincinnati Medical School, has evaluated many paedophiles, and he stated in 2005 that Jackson simply does not fit the usual profile of a child sex offender. Jackson's eccentric behavior is not typical of this kind of offender. In fact, most sex offenders are quote-unquote normal people and often don't stand out in any way. They don't want to draw attention to themselves. If anything, they wish to disappear into a crowd. Further, whilst many cite Jackson's childlike persona and keeping toys and children's items in his home, Borak refutes that this is not a paedophile trait. Most paedophiles will keep toys and childish possessions in their home to lure children, yes, but these are usually hidden away, and not just from visitors in their home, but from themselves. They don't want a reminder of who they are, and they certainly wouldn't play with such items, much like Jackson did. These opinions are echoed by Richard Lawler, chief of outpatient forensic child psychiatry services at the Indiana School of Medicine. He stated that many paedophiles will display some form of arrested development, focusing their attention on young children over adults. They will become fixated during development, but science doesn't yet tell us why. Lawler went on to say that Jackson's childish demeanor would be very rare amongst paedophiles, though, going as far as to say that he has never seen it amongst the many, many cases of paedophilia he has researched and witnessed. Back in 2001, German psychologist Dieter Speck spoke on German national television regarding Michael Jackson's revelations in the now infamous Martin Bashir interview, and regarding his psychological makeup. Speck stated the following translated verbatim comment.
His father said in an interview 2 years ago that had he not beaten his son, then the latter wouldn't have ended up as number one in the pop business. Thus, Michael was afraid of his father, and at the same time always craved the love of his father. Meanwhile, his father Joe would mock Michael's face, his nose, and his acne. Michael wanted to please his father, I would say paradoxically, because he was so afraid of him. Michael never got the love from his father that he craved for, and this love was left behind all of his life. What he is doing now is that he gathers children around him and wants to have children around in order to be a father to them, a father figure that he himself never had. Michael is in fact child and father in one single person. What he does with children, he actually does with himself, in a genuine, completely innocent, and completely good-hearted way. Far from a naive person, Martin Bashir has tricked him. He has taken full advantage of him.
There are, of course, detractors to this psychological evidence, however. One of those is Jim Clemente, an ex-New York State prosecutor and FBI profiler who specialized in behavioral analysis and worked under the Sexual Exploitation of Children's Task Force throughout the 1980s. Clemente believes that Michael Jackson does in fact fit the profile of a pedophile, and that Michael Jackson certainly did have child porn at Neverland. Clemente was interviewed on Good Morning America in 1996, and he had the following to say.
They found images, and I think they were of a photo shoot with Michael Jackson's nephew, Taj. I think he was still a teenager when the photos were taken. And there's a picture that's out there. It's a picture of Michael and Taj. So there are pictures in this series where Michael is actually grabbing the cloth that Taj is wearing, and he is trying to rip it off. He's laughing and joking and trying to get him naked. And he's virtually naked in this picture, too. This is his nephew, and he was a 40-something-year-old man. Why is he posing in a picture where Michael's shirt is open, exposing his chest and this kid's chest? I mean, he's basically naked. He's got no underwear on right next to Michael Jackson. I mean, it's disgusting.
The image that Clemente is referring to is the photo shoot that Michael Jackson did with his nephew's band 3T in late 1995. The image was used as the cover for the 1996 single, Why? A lot of Clemente's comments in this interview are grossly inaccurate, and he seems to be relying on the public's ignorance to just believe him and take his word for it. You can view the image by going to www.deathcult.com/Jackson. Michael Jackson's nephew Taj, who is one of the members of 3T, actually issued a rebuttal to Clemente. Here are some of the things that he had to say. Present at the shoot, there is wardrobe, there is a camera director, there was makeup. I was uncomfortable taking off my shirt, so I didn't have to take off my shirt. It was never said, no, you must take off your shirt, and you do this and you do that. We were given the freedom to do whatever we wanted to do. Now, unfortunately, people are trying to dirty it. It was just an edgy image. Although by today's standards, it's just a fully clothed Michael standing next to his nephew, who is also fully clothed, but has his shirt unbuttoned all the way down. Clemente mentioned that Michael's laughing during the shoot. Well, that's because we were all joking. We were trying to do something edgy, but that cracked us all up and made us laugh. There's plenty of people present that witnessed everything, and they would back up my story or my uncle's story if he was still alive. But at the same time, there is this random guy who basically is just guessing what happened at the photo shoot by pictures and wants to assume the worst. Michael, however, never issued a rebuttal to those accusations. And looking at the evidence of his communications and media appearances, maybe that was one of Michael's biggest problems. Friends and fans of Michael would accuse him of being too nice, too innocent, and too trusting. And eventually, that led to his partial downfall. Macaulay Culkin conducted an interview on 60 Minutes with Larry King in 2005. One of the comments he made was this. Yeah, you have to understand the whole scenario, man. And the thing is with Michael, is he's not very good at explaining himself. I mean, he never really has been. Caroline Frisdet, a 2005 Michael Jackson trial defense witness from Stockholm in Sweden, said the following. Michael was going to Miami, so myself and a couple of friends flew in from Europe to spend some time with him before he left. And before he had to go, he told us that we could stay and that we can enjoy Neverland as much as we wanted. While the ranch manager took us to the main house, he told me that Michael had said, give us the royal treatment, and we sure got the royal treatment. When we went up to the main house, all the staff were lined up on the stairs welcoming us, and they told us that we could move around as freely as we wanted to. There were no places that were off limits. 1993. Evan Chandler was born in New York. He was born Evan Charmatz, but he wanted a career as a screenwriter. So he moved to California and changed his name from Charmatz to Chandler because he thought Charmatz was too Jewish sounding. He became a dentist. He was actually Carrie Fisher's dentist, but he didn't enjoy the job. He felt he was destined for bigger and better things. Throw in the fact that many sources state that Evan was not very good at his job either. He was censored by the regulatory board for poor work in 1993. He had a very, very brief career as a screenwriter, with his one screenwriting credit, again in 1993, being for the Mel Brooks comedy Robin Hood Men in Tights. 1993 would turn out to be a pretty big year for Chandler. While he was working with Mel Brooks, he came up with the idea of Men in Tights, or rather, his 13-year-old son came up with the idea, Men in Tights. Mel Brooks decided it was a great idea and went along with the dentist and they put the movie together. The other writer on the project was David Shapiro, him who wrote Battlefield Earth, the John Travolta-fronted Scientology movie. Men in Tights did moderately well, and as a fairly average review on Metacritic, Rotten Tomatoes, and IMDb, it will be Chandler's only movie, unfortunately. A Dentist to the Stars would be exposed to a lot of the Hollywood glitz. No doubt, he could see his successful customers talking on the phone, making deals, and it looked so easy to someone on the outside. Anyway, he decided he wanted a piece of that, eventually settling on screenwriter-producer, and that would fill his boots. Now, Evan Chandler had briefly been married to June Chandler, originally June Wong, and they had a child together, 13-year-old Jordan Chandler. June Chandler had divorced Evan by 1992 and married a man named David Schwartz. June and Schwartz had full custody of young Jordan. So let's skip back to May 1992. Michael Jackson is in Los Angeles with some of his entourage. The entourage is driving along Wilshire Boulevard at Beverly Hills and their car breaks down. The entourage get out and try to ascertain what the issue is, but they can't find nor fix it. Then, driving past, a lady spots Michael Jackson standing by the side of the road next to his smoking vehicle. The lady calls her husband, who works at a business called Rent-A-Rec. It's a used car rental and leasing business, but they have a tow truck, and she wants to help a megastar. Rent-A-Wreck is owned by David Schwartz. So when David Schwartz hears about the call that's come in, he calls his wife June, because he knows that his stepson Jordan is a massive Michael Jackson fan, and he figures this might be a great opportunity for Jordan to come down and meet his hero. Fairly innocent. Now, there was an employer at Rent-A-Wreck named Martin Green. Green said that when June arrived at the breakdown location with Jordan, she was kind of forcing Jordan on Michael Jackson, almost like trying to emotionally blackmail the star, and she was very imposing. From all accounts, however, it appears that Michael thought that he owed the boy something, Green said, and so telephone numbers were exchanged, and both parties ended up staying in touch. A lot can be said for fate, right? Anyway, in February 1993, Jordan, or Jordy to his family and Michael, visits Neverland Ranch with his mother and younger sister by invitation from Jackson. A friendship quickly develops between Michael and the Chandler family, or at least between Michael, Jordy, June and David Schwartz at least. I mention these specific names because what the friendship doesn't include is a friendship with Evan Chandler, and why would it? During this period, Michael Jackson will often stay over at June Chandler's house. June and Jordy would also sleep over at Jackson's house too. The Daily Mirror reports this in March of 1993. So where is Evan Chandler during this period of time? Well, Evan Chandler was essentially an absent father in Jordy's life. In 1993, he owned around $70,000 in unpaid child support, and he rarely saw Jordan. Evan and June had been arguing a lot during this time too, as June was angry at how infrequently Evan was seeing his son. June wanted Evan to take Jordan more often and arrange regular, consistent visits to Evan. Evan was refusing. He had remarried and had a new family of his own. Plus, the more he saw Jordy and June, the more pressure would be put upon him to pay his increasing child support bill, which he could not afford. Evan, at best, struggled to engage with Jordy. Then, he discovered that his son was now friends with Michael Jackson. Almost overnight, Evan suddenly became interested in seeing his son again. In May of 1993, Michael Jackson first meets Evan Chandler. Initially, him and Jackson seemed to be getting on really well, although Evan quickly overstepped the mark with Michael. He asked Michael to build an extra wing onto his Neverland home so that Geordie could come and stay more often. Michael wasn't keen on the idea, so Evan suggested a better idea. "Why don't you just build me a new house?" he said. Honestly, the ignorance and confidence of this guy. Anyway, that didn't happen, but strangely, Jackson didn't kick Evan out or see through his money-grabbing cloak. No, Jackson remained cordial and friendly to Evan. June then dropped the bombshell that she and Geordie were going on tour with Michael. Evan, who previously had been an absent father who wasn't paying his child support and not interested in seeing his son, became enraged about the idea that Geordie would be out of the country for a few months, meaning he wouldn't get to see him. At this point, this is where the relationship took a dramatic turn towards the negative. Evan had also begun making strange comments and threats to June, David and Geordie about Michael. Evan said he was going to make allegations about him. Evan was behaving so erratically that they feared he was going to do something crazy. So the next time they spoke to Evan on the telephone, they tape recorded him. This conversation took place on July the 8th, 1993, when Evan Chandler called David Schwartz.
"This man is going to be humiliated beyond belief. He will not believe it. He will not believe what's going to happen to him. Beyond his worst nightmares, sell one more record."
"This attorney I found, I mean, I interviewed several, and I picked the nastiest son of a bitch I could find. Once I make that phone call, this guy is just going to destroy everybody in sight in any devious, nasty, cruel way that he can do it. And I've given him full authority to do that. It'll be a massacre if I don't get what I want.
If I go through with this, I win big time.
I will get everything I want, and they will be destroyed forever. They will be destroyed. June is going to lose Geordie. She will have no right to ever see him again."
"Yeah.
That's a fact, Dave. That's what's going
to happen. Michael's
career will be over.
Does that help Geordie?
Michael's career will be over.
And does that help Geordie?
That's irrelevant to me."
Apologies for the quality of that recording. Chandler had gone from 0 to 100 in a split second. He's furious that Michael has stopped calling him and stopped taking his calls, and how Michael has stolen his ex-wife and torn the family apart, his words. He's plotting his revenge, and he says cryptically that everything is moving forward in accordance with a plan that is not just his. So Evan Chandler hires attorney Barry Rothman. Rothman is a vicious litigator. At that time in the early 90s, he works for the most part in the entertainment industry as an entertainment attorney, but he had a history of being a really strong negotiator, in the entertainment field at least. Diverting slightly off topic for a small second, a secretary that was employed throughout the 1990s by Barry Rothman came forward after Jackson's death. Her name is Geraldine Hughes. Hughes made the following comments about her time working at Rothman's legal practice in 1993.
"I was the only legal secretary for Barry Rothman. I handled all his work. Whenever Evan Chandler would call Barry Rothman's office, Barry would tell us to put the call on hold, and he would walk all the way back to his office and shut the door. And that's how he took all of Evan's calls. Evan was the only client who Barry did that for. If anybody else called and Barry was away from his office, he would just pick up any phone and have a conversation, no matter how private or sensitive the discussion was. But he didn't do that with Evan Chandler. Their conversations were always the only private conversations that Barry had behind closed doors."
Pretty interesting, right? So, through his attorney, Evan Chandler accused Michael Jackson of child molestation against his 13-year-old son, Geordie. He didn't report the crime to the police, however. Now, Geordie Chandler was insisting that Michael had never touched him. So Michael Jackson's legal team sends their investigator, Anthony Pelicano, around to interview Geordie Chandler. Geordie was interviewed on record and tape recorded. Pelicano questions Geordie for around an hour. Pelicano asks him a number of pointed and very direct questions. "Have you ever seen Michael Jackson naked? Have you ever gone naked in bed with Michael Jackson? Has Michael Jackson ever touched you sexually, etc., etc.?" Geordie Chandler answers no to every single question. At the end of the conversation, Geordie Chandler reiterates that Michael has never done anything wrong to him, then says that his dad is just trying to get money. This is recorded and remains on record. Geraldine Hughes comments again, saying that it started out as a custody issue. Evan Chandler wanted the custody of Geordie, because in order to coerce a child into saying something that's not true, you need time with that child. So Evan Chandler goes to custody court and tells the judge that he wants a week of custody with his son. June Chandler agrees on the basis that he will be returned after 7 days. Even though Evan agrees to this, he doesn't comply and doesn't give Geordie back. During the custody period, Evan took Geordie to Rothman's office on a number of occasions. Hughes confirms that the three of them, Evan, Geordie and Barry Rothman, would lock themselves in Rothman's office for hours at a time. Now this next part is pretty crazy. It's like something out of a movie. A pretty bad movie, and certainly not something you would believe if you were told it. But medical records and eyewitnesses support that the following occurred that same week. While Geordie was in Evan's custody, Evan sedated him to conduct a dental procedure. Remember, Evan was a qualified dentist. He uses a drug called sodium amytal. This is where things start to get murky, as sodium amytal is not a drug that's commonly used in dentistry. It's not used in dentistry at all. But regardless, Evan gives Geordie this drug and sedates him. So what do we know about this drug? Well, up until the 1980s, it was used by a number of government agencies throughout the world, as it was thought to have been an effective truth serum. Hell, the CIA used it. The only problem was, in the late 80s, scientists ascertained that it wasn't effective as a truth serum at all. In fact, it was quite the opposite. If you look at current medical journals like Psychology Today or The Lancet, you'll see that it isn't a truth serum, and this was widely known by 1993. What sodium amytal actually did was it made those who took it massively suggestible and susceptible to compelling assertions. In effect, you could administer somebody with sodium amytal and then plant an idea in their head, and when they woke up, they would believe what you had told them was true. So what happens next? That's right, Geordie changes his story. He went into Evan's custody saying that he wasn't abused by Michael Jackson. Not long after, he claims that yes, in fact, he has been abused. Smoke and fire, anyone? If the drugging of his own son and coercing him into making a false accusation wasn't enough, Evan then still doesn't go to the police, as you would expect a parent to do if their child had said they'd been sexually abused. No, Evan instead goes directly to Michael Jackson's legal team and demands $20 million. Don't forget that Evan had a desire to be a filmmaker. Jackson and his legal team knew this. Evan even said he would use the money from Michael Jackson to fund his own movie. So instead of laughing Evan out of the room, and although Michael is adamant that he's not going to give Evan Chandler a single penny, let alone $20 million, MJ's legal team do actually offer a counteroffer to Evan. The counteroffer is a deal for three scripts, and Evan will be paid $350,000 per script, which is a hell of a generous offer to give a man who is essentially fraudulently trying to steal your money. Michael even said to Evan, "I'll contribute that to your film project as a chance to give you and your son an opportunity to heal," because at that time, Evan was saying publicly that Michael had stolen his son's affection. Evan actually recorded that in the legal paperwork. He said, "My son is being starstruck by this superstar and Michael has stolen my son's affection," verbatim. Michael reportedly felt huge guilt about this, and his comments in the legal office stated, "This will be a great opportunity for you and Geordie to reconnect because you'll be able to write the scripts together." Jackson was trying to defuse the situation in a very generous manner. The comms back from Barry Rothman by fax said the following: "You're nowhere near what we're asking for. That's less than $2 million. We are not accepting that." Money for literal nothing. 48 hours later, the Jackson legal camp responded with another offer, a single payment of $350,000. This shocked Barry Rothman because it was even lower than the initial offer. Evan and Rothman figured that Jackson's camp was not serious about negotiating and were trying to call their bluff. So Evan Chandler suggests that he is willing to take the original $1 million three scripts deal. Anthony Pelicano delivered a fax response within minutes. It simply said, "That's never going to happen." On August the 16th, 1993, Evan and June both file sole custody requests for Jordy. But in addition, June files an ex parte motion. This motion, if approved by the judge, means that all parties involved in the case must show up in court the very next day. June was trying to get Jordy back and playing hardball. So Evan went to court. But don't forget, Evan had been negotiating with Michael's legal team for a whole month prior to this court date, for the not-so-small sum of $20 million. So Evan goes to court. In front of a family law judge, Evan says nothing about his suspicion or knowledge of his child being molested. This would have been a perfect time to raise it in a legal capacity, not to mention he could have argued that the molestation occurred while Jordy was under June's care. Therefore, he should have sole custody of Jordy to ensure better protection of his son. But no, he didn't say anything. So the judge ordered him to return Jordy back to June instantly. So now, in order to regain custody, Evan will need to go to a psychiatrist and have Jordy disclose the molestation accusation on record, then return to the court with the official record. Evan fucked up. But just 3 days later, the breaking news emerged. Evan didn't return Jordy to June. Instead, he took him to a doctor that he had already set up the molestation accusation with, and the doctor signed off on it, adding it to official medical and court records. Evan is panicking and losing control, though, because he triggers the criminal proceedings by obtaining the doctor's statement. That means that Evan loses control of the negotiating situation with the Jackson's attorneys, and all discussions cease because the police are now involved. Evan says to a number of people, including June and David Schwartz, that he doesn't want the police involved and he regrets his actions. But why, if you have discovered a man has been molesting your teenage son, why wouldn't you want the police to take action? For those of our listeners who were around in 1993 and have memory of these events, you'll know that the media went into a frenzy. It was utter insanity. Once the Michael Jackson case kicked in, their ratings went through the roof. It was astronomical the difference that the story made to the ratings of shows like Hard Copy and A Current Affair. And story on the news about Michael Jackson drove the ratings sky high, and the subsequent advertising generated millions for the television stations, newspapers, and magazines. At the time, this was considered the story of the decade, if not one of the greatest stories of the century. Remember, Michael Jackson was at the peak of his fame and possibly one of the most famous people on the planet. This was an era with no internet and no social media. There was a real thirst for knowledge about Michael Jackson, as he was so reclusive. People knew very little about him. This was a time where celebrities could have anonymity and a private life away from the world. But to the press, there was a real need to keep the story going every single day. They needed a new Michael Jackson story or angle, because that was where the ratings were coming from, and ratings meant money. So the impetus was there for journalists to seize on anything, literally anything that came up, anything that looked like a scoop or a scandal or looked like it might bring in the ratings. They just ran with any story they could. Truth, accuracy, authenticity, or facts didn't matter. What they didn't have, they could make up. Not sleazy or scandalous enough? No problem. We'll jazz up the details a little. Didn't have any new information? That's okay, we'll just completely make something up and claim the info came from an anonymous source. Tabloid news. In 1993, after the accusations against Jackson were made, MJ released a video statement that said, in verbatim, "I will say that I am particularly upset by the handling of this massive media matter, by the incredible, terrible mass media. At every opportunity, the media has dissected and manipulated these allegations to reach their own conclusions. I ask all of you to wait and hear the truth before you label or condemn me. Don't treat me like a criminal, because I am innocent." One prime example from the time was where the National Enquirer contacted a Jackson family friend by the name of Ron Newt. They invited him to a lavish hotel suite and offered him $200,000 for information about Michael Jackson. Initially, Newt said, "Sure, of course, I'm here to help Michael." At which point, the National Enquirer representative replied with, "Oh, no, no. We don't want to help him. We want you to say that he touched your children in a sexual manner." I know. Repeatedly, people of dubious character were treated as credible sources if they would come forward with any information on Michael. There were people who changed their story depending on how much money the press outlet offered them. Paul Baresi, a tabloid story broker, famously stated in 1994, "The first time I heard the story about Jackson, it went, his hand was outside the kid's pants. They were asking for 100 grand. As soon as the price went up to 500 grand, the hand went inside the kid's pants. So come on." LaToya Jackson. Something that really harmed Michael Jackson's reputation at the time of the initial accusations in 1993 were the comments made by his own sister, LaToya. LaToya actually stated in a number of televised interviews that she believed that Michael was guilty and was in fact a pedophile. Why the hell would she do that? What information did she have to support these claims against a member of her own family? Well, LaToya Jackson at the time was married to a man named Jack Gordon. Gordon was involved with the Genovese crime family. He was also known to be a very disturbed character, both violent and abusive. Gordon was also LaToya's manager and was put in that position by Joe Jackson, who was fully aware of Gordon's reputation. Under Gordon's management, LaToya's image became more sexualized. He would pimp LaToya out like a prostitute, so to speak, and forced her to do semi-pornographic magazine shoots, for example Playboy magazine in 1989 and 1991, and a subsequent Playboy video in 1990. If LaToya disagreed with him or refused to do anything that he told her to do, then he would either beat her or threaten to have members of her family killed. This is by her own admission. This went on from 1989 to 1997, so a good number of years. It was heavily reported on at the time of the marriage breaking up in late 1996. And LaToya herself went on a number of talk shows and conducted many interviews following a divorce, talking about the horrific abuse that she went through at the hands of Gordon, with him even forcing her to distance herself from her family in fear that he would injure or kill them. So all of a sudden, LaToya suddenly started selling interviews, claiming that her brother was definitely guilty. These interviews would sell for tens of thousands of dollars a pop. Jack Gordon decided at the time of the allegations that there was a lot of money to be made from peddling scandal and saying that Michael was guilty. And indeed, there was. Lupus. Dr. Robert LaHita is a rheumatologist from Paterson, New Jersey. He examined Michael Jackson and recorded in the pop star's medical records that Jackson suffered from lupus. Lupus is an autoimmune disease where the immune system, one of our body's largest systems that's designed to protect us against germs and viruses, actually attacks our own body's cells and tissue. Many patients with lupus also suffer with vitiligo. Michael had a form of skin lupus called discoid lupus, which affects about 40% of patients with lupus, and sufferers regularly experience vitiligo and deep skin pigmentation. Jackson announced in a 1993 interview with Oprah Winfrey that he suffered with vitiligo, and that's what caused his skin to lighten. Still, however, the press were convinced this was a lie to cover up numerous surgeries to make him white because he hated being black. Jackson reiterated in numerous interviews and multiple times over the years that he suffered with vitiligo, but it wasn't until his autopsy and death certificate was released, which was conducted by Dr. Chandra Soma, professor of pathology at US School of Medicine, that confirmed that he had this disease, and that the public and media eventually accepted the fact. Whilst Jackson suffered with lupus, he only had skin involvement. But this had destroyed part of the skin tissue of his nose, and his nasal surgeries were all really reconstructive to try and look normal. Again, the press found out that as a child his father would mock him and call him Big Nose, and that this must be the real reason for his surgery, a vanity operation. Vitiligo is a very debilitating condition. It doesn't turn you from brown to white all in one go. It happens in many tiny increments and at different speeds all over your body. So it can leave you almost looking like a paint splatter or blood splatter randomly placed over your body. We have placed a few photographs of Michael on our website, which shows the slow change in skin colour that Michael endured. If you head on over to www.deathcult.com/Jackson, you can take a look at those images there. Why is Michael Jackson's vitiligo and lupus relevant to all of this anyway? Well, the allegation by Evan Chandler was that his son could accurately describe discoloration of Michael Jackson's genitals, the discoloration being caused by vitiligo. The Chandlers seek and obtain a warrant which allows them to force Michael Jackson to submit to a naked photo shoot and body interrogation by the Los Angeles Police Department. Following the forced examination, Michael Jackson released the following video statement to news agencies from his Neverland Ranch.
I have been forced to submit to a dehumanizing and humiliating examination by the Santa Barbara County Sheriff Department and the Los Angeles Police Department earlier this week. They served a search warrant on me which allowed them to view and photograph my body, including my penis, my buttocks, my lower torso, thighs, and any other area that they wanted. They were supposedly looking for any discoloration, spotting, blotches, or other evidence of a skin color disorder called vitiligo, which I have previously spoken about. The warrant also directed me to cooperate in any examination of my body by their physician to determine the condition of my skin, including whether I have vitiligo or any other skin disorder. The warrant further stated that I had no right to refuse the examination or photographs, and if I failed to cooperate with them, they would introduce that refusal at any trial as an indication of my guilt. It was the most humiliating ordeal of my life, one that no person should ever have to suffer. And even after experiencing the indignity of this search, the parties involved were still not satisfied and wanted to take even more pictures. It was a nightmare, a horrifying nightmare. But if this is what I have to endure to prove my innocence, my complete innocence, so be it.
In a book by Evan Chandler's brother, Ray Chandler, he quotes Evan as having a discussion with his personal lawyer, Larry Feldman, law enforcement and district attorney, Gil Garcetti. They're discussing Michael Jackson's vitiligo situation. Law enforcement have disclosed to the Chandler family that Michael has a skin condition called vitiligo. The skin condition can regularly change the way that your body looks due to its ongoing attacks against the pigmentation within the skin. So the district attorney at the time, Gil Garcetti, you might remember him from the O.J. Simpson case, well, Garcetti tells the Chandler family that this works out great for them. Garcetti states, it's great because if Jordan Chandler's description matches Jackson's genitalia, then it's proof that Jordy has seen Michael's penis. But if Jordy's description doesn't match, then they can say, oh well, that's because of the vitiligo and the pigmentation has changed since Jordan saw it. Larry Feldman comments, either way, we win. In January 1994, law enforcement sources tell two different media outlets, Reuters and USA Today, that there is no match between what Jordan's descriptions are and the body search of Jackson that the police conducted. Jordan Chandler's illustration of Michael Jackson's genitalia has since been leaked and is now available online. For the record, I won't be hosting the image on my website. But if you can track it down and you look carefully at what's written on the document, it has phrases such as my theory and to be selective. Now remember that this document was produced by a 13-year-old boy. Are these truly Jordy's own descriptions or phrases? They don't seem like the words or descriptors of a 13-year-old boy to me. On a side note, it's worth mentioning too that prior to the relationship between the Chandlers and Michael breaking down, Evan Chandler had assisted Michael by administering painkillers to Jackson through injections to his buttocks at Michael's request. This is in the trial deposition. So at the very least, Evan had seen Jackson's gluteus and knew that he had discoloration on his lower body region, thus guiding Jordy's statements further if he so wanted to. Okay, let's talk the Linden affidavit. So I'm going to try and explain this without getting too graphic. Santa Barbara Deputy Sheriff Detective Deborah Linden submitted a sworn affidavit to the court during case depositions. Now, Detective Linden was part of the same team who were investigating the Jordy Chandler case. She was present at the forced body search of Michael Jackson. Detective Linden took from Jordy a written description of Michael Jackson's genitals. Jordy also tells Linden that he clearly remembers Michael being circumcised. Jordy even documents his comments by drawing a picture of the genitalia he claims Jackson had, detailed down to the circumcision. The kicker is, though, that when the police conducted the body search, it turned out that Michael Jackson was not circumcised, meaning that Jordy's description does not match. Linden signed a legal affidavit to the court confirming these events. The Los Angeles Police Department also retained photographs of MJ's body search, which support the Linden affidavit. At this point, Jackson is seeming like a pushover and a flake, so I just want to clarify at this stage that in late August 1993, Michael Jackson files extortion charges against Evan Chandler and Barry Rothman. He wants a game to control the narrative. So shaken by this news, Barry Rothman resigns as the chief attorney for the Chandler family. To replace Rothman, Evan Chandler immediately hires Gloria Allred. Allred, it seems, wasn't fully brought up to speed, nor did she read the case files, because right away she proceeds to hold a press conference and announces that the Chandlers are ready for a criminal case. Oops. As you would assume, Gloria Allred is quickly fired and Barry Rothman resumes representation, although now he is working very much in the background. Plausible deniability. Officially, though, Larry Feldman is named as the replacement to Allred, and the attorney is willing to push for a civil case as the primary agenda. For anyone that's listening that doesn't know the difference between a civil and a criminal case, I'll explain. Criminal law defines what activity is illegal and punishes the offender. Its aim is to prevent offenders from reoffending the same crime. In a criminal lawsuit, the conflict is generally between a governmental authority and a person or persons. Civil law is to ensure the constitutional right of a civilian. In most civil cases, the conflict is generally between two or more private parties. The trial process and punishment also differ significantly from one to the other. Simply put, if you lose a case in a criminal suit, you could face jail, a fine, enforced public service, or a number of judgments the government imposed via a district or federal judge. If you lose a civil suit, the outcome is generally that you pay the opposing side a sum of money, which is decided by the civil judge. By late 1993, five separate search warrants are carried out on Michael Jackson's properties. These all took place while Jackson was touring outside of the United States, so authorities had total and complete free will to ransack Jackson's addresses. In all five searches, nothing incriminating was found. Nothing. This as per police and court documents. The criminal case now stalls due to lack of evidence. A judge even allows and issues warrants for law enforcement to search Jackson's parents' house, Havenhurst, and also Jackson's doctor's office, seizing all of his medical records. There is still no incriminating evidence found. Now, the authorities aren't stupid, but at the same time, they have launched a public investigation into one of the biggest stars on the planet, so they don't want to seem inept to the public either. They know that they have got a boy at the center of the case who at first said he wasn't molested, then said that he was. They know the change of heart came after some coaching, shall we say, and a dental procedure. So the authorities don't want to put all their eggs in one basket. This is when the police go looking for other victims of sexual abuse at the hands of Jackson. First, they track down and speak to dozens of fans who Jackson has had visit his Neverland Ranch. Every one of them deny any improper behaviour on Jackson's part. A lot of them are female fans. The police then decide to focus on Michael's young male companions who spent the most time with him. The police interview Macaulay Culkin, Corey Feldman, Brett Barnes, Jimmy Safechuck, and Wade Robson. All five boys vehemently deny that Jackson had abused them and all deny any wrongdoing on Jackson's part regarding their interactions with him. Corey Feldman went as far to say that he was never abused by Jackson, but did give the police names of other paedophile abusers in Hollywood, some who had actually abused him when he was younger. The police do nothing with this information, however. They were solely focused on trying to find incriminating information against Michael Jackson. This again came to light after the death of Corey Haim in 2010, where yet again the police took no further action. The criminal case basically stalls. There is just no evidence. In October 1993, the judge in the civil case moves forward and orders depositions. A deposition is where you are forced to state your case and give your evidence under oath. It can be done in court or under oath elsewhere and videotaped, usually at an attorney's office. Michael Jackson is ordered to be deposed by January 1994. The problem with this is that if you have a civil case which comes before the criminal case and you are forced to give away your defense strategy, then it gives the prosecutors a front row seat for your defense. They can then go away and tailor their criminal case around your defense. For example, if you say, "I have an alibi," in the civil case, the prosecutors can tailor their criminal case to change your alibi dates and times, etc. Or they could just change their case altogether to get around the alibi. If you have a witness, they can discredit that witness or work to undermine their credibility. They take out your defense piece by piece, essentially. It's like showing your hand in a poker game while all the other players are still in the game. So by the time you come to criminal court, you have no defense anymore and likely will face jail. That's a huge problem when a civil case precedes a criminal case. Because from October 1993 to January 1994, Michael's defense team speaks to the judge on four separate occasions and argues that the civil case must be delayed so that it doesn't proceed or influence the criminal case. It's actually unconstitutional. The judge denies all four attempts. The denial comes, as Larry Feldman argues, that Jordy Chandler is a child, therefore his memory is not fully developed, and he would be at risk of losing his memory if the testimony is not heard quickly. Jordy, however, was by then 14 years of age, which in the legal sense wasn't too young. However, the judge still agreed with Feldman on all four occasions. Evan Chandler, at this time, submits a request to the court to ensure that the civil case occurs before the criminal case. Legally, that should not have been agreed to because that contravened Michael's constitutional rights. However, Evan's request is successful. Jackson's deposition is scheduled for January 18, 1994. Now, the Northridge earthquake on January 17, 1994 in Los Angeles occurs the day before the deposition. An act of God, you could say. That means the deposition is pushed back by a week until January 25th. But within that week, Jackson's team again try to postpone the civil case, but are again refused. Fifth time's a charm. Now, any good attorney will tell you that if a judge is repeatedly ruling against you in motion after motion, that it might be time to consider settling, as that judge is clearly not siding with your case. The Jackson legal team consider just that and bring on famous LA attorney Johnny Corcoran. Another OJ reference there. Corcoran was negotiating with the insurance company, and at first the insurance company said no, they weren't going to pay the settlement amount. Corcoran and the insurance company went back and forth for quite some time, but eventually, because Corcoran was a fierce negotiator, Corcoran eventually convinced the insurance company to pay the settlement. When Michael Jackson eventually settled the case, the judge in the civil case also made Jackson drop his extortion claim against the Chandlers. Side note here, whenever I hear detractors in this case, or any other case for that matter, who say, oh, he must have been guilty, why else would he pay them all that money, etc. Well, that money doesn't come out of the defendant's own wallet. It's paid for by legal insurance coverage. Just FYI. The amount of the settlement is kept tightly under wraps. We know now, however, that the sum was $23 million. The settlement agreement also included a specific clause which said that the settlement doesn't preclude anybody involved from testifying in a criminal case. And then, to reiterate that at a press conference announcing the settlement, Larry Feldman specifically denies that his settlement will have any impact on the criminal case, which he and we now know is BS, as there was no criminal case. The only reason the criminal investigation hadn't been thrown out already was because the district attorney wanted to see how the civil case played out and hoped that evidence would emerge there that they could use in the criminal case. Obviously, it didn't. The sad truth in all of this that never gets discussed is that Michael Jackson was the victim of an elaborate extortion scheme against him. It was perpetuated and inflamed by the mass media looking to line their pockets and increase their power by extrapolating false rumours and fake stories to increase Jackson's infamy. It wasn't the first time this happened on a grand scale, and it will not be the last. Michael Jackson never got his day in court, nor never got the opportunity to deliver his evidence or side of the story. Unfortunately for Wacko Jacko, he had been charged and sentenced in the court of public opinion. In 2004, Jackson was again accused of sexual misconduct against a child by another young male companion named Gavin Arvizo. On June 13, 2005, Michael Jackson was found not guilty by the jury on all 14 charges. Michael Jackson passed away on June 25, 2009. 5 months later, on November 5, 2009, Evan Chandler committed suicide. The suicide was not linked in any way to Jackson's death. On May 1, 2013, Wade Robson filed a civil lawsuit against the estate of Michael Jackson, seeking monetary compensation for lost earning opportunities as a result of alleged sexual abuse from Michael Jackson. The civil lawsuit came months after Robson experienced two nervous breakdowns caused by what he cited as a failing career and being declined by the Jackson estate to the opportunity to work on the Michael Jackson 1 Cirque du Soleil production. On May 14, 2013, the Safechuck family business was served with a $24 million lawsuit. On May 20, 2013, a week later, James Safechuck disclosed alleged childhood sexual abuse by Michael Jackson. He hires Robson's lawyer and files a civil lawsuit against Jackson's estate. Their lawyer sought the help of Jordan Chandler, but Chandler refused to be deposed or get involved in the case in any way. Both Robson and Safechuck's civil lawsuits were dismissed in 2017. Both appealed their decisions, and they were both thrown out once again in 2020 and 2021 respectively due to lack of evidence. In 2017, filmmaker Danny Wu approached a friend of Jordan Chandler whom he met in a New York college in 2001. Chandler's friend, Josephine Zoni, stated in a recorded interview that Jordan Chandler had told her that he felt very used by his parents and that he wasn't in contact with them any longer. She also stated that Jordan Chandler had said to her that he believed that Michael Jackson wasn't capable of the things he was being accused of and that he believed he was innocent of child molestation in every single case. All of Michael Jackson's five accusers only sought monetary compensation and none of them went to the police to report the alleged crimes committed against them.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to our show tonight. Be sure to leave us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform and subscribe to our show so that you never miss an episode. Our shows aren't sponsored by any company or corporation, so any support you can give us goes a long way in supporting the work that we do. Visit deathcult.com for more information on how you can help us and support our broadcasts. There you can also find links to our socials, Patreon, and episodes. From all of us here at Dead Souls, sleep tight.